I'm Anita Lustria, and this is Faith Conversations. Today on the podcast, I'm thrilled to have Shauna Nyquist joining me, and I've followed her writings through the years. Probably a lot of you have too, but if you are new to Shauna and are thinking, wait, I don't know that name, or ooh, maybe I've heard that name, today we're going to focus in on a new book that she's written, Present Over Perfect. Subtitle, Leaving Behind Frantic for a Simpler, More Soulful Way of Living. So yeah, take a deep breath if that's you. And I think it's probably about 97.5% of all of us that are living in a way that actually doesn't invite us to that deeper way of life, and certainly not toward a more soulful way of living. Sometimes we don't know how to get there. We're going to talk a little bit about that today. And most of you who are used to listening to Faith Conversations know that my marketing budget is zero, and you're my wonderful, lovely marketers. So if you would share the post on Facebook, you know, once you've listened, I would love that, or grab it on, you know, from my Facebook page and share it. That'd be awesome. Well, let me tell you a little bit about Shauna if you're unfamiliar. She wrote the book Cold Tangerines, Bittersweet, Bread and Wine, and Savor. You got to love all those titles. All of them have something to do with food, don't they? All right, we'll talk about that too. She's married to Aaron. They've got these two adorable boys, Henry and Mac, and they live outside of Chicago. And, you know, you'll hear some of that life coming through even as we talk today. So, Shauna, welcome to Faith Conversations.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm delighted that you can join me from your, what, kitchen, living room, office? Where do you talk on Skype to somebody?
My kitchen table.
Oh, I love it. Yep. I'm in my little spiritual direction room / studio, and it's just comfortable. I've got my ceiling fan going on this summer day, and as we start moving toward fall. So I'm glad to have you here and ecstatic to see you tackling this topic, because I'll tell you what my assessment, if I were to say, to describe Shauna Nyquist, and I don't know you well, but have interacted off and on through the years, you know, interviewing you about a book or running into you somewhere, I would say competent, capable, effective, strong, you know, those are the kind of adjectives that I would have used to describe you. And my guess is probably a lot of people in your sphere would have done the same. Is that accurate?
I think so, probably.
Okay. All right. But that's me from the outside looking in. So, you know, that's not always the real deal, but certainly, you know, I saw you as someone who point to you and you could stand up, and whether you were, quote, prepared or not, you could speak to an issue or a topic, or, you know, talk for 15 to 30 minutes. And maybe some of that's because you come from a pastor's family too, which I do. I think some of that's kind of built into us, isn't it, or modeled for us. And so I think you've been able to do all of that and have written eloquently through the years, and maybe what, a book a year, something like that. I don't know how it's exactly been. But then here comes Present Over Perfect, Leaving Behind Frantic for a Simpler, More Soulful Way of Living. And I'm thinking, all right, if Shauna Nyquist is going to engage in this journey, I have to talk with her. And I want to know what happened. Where did Present Over Perfect come from? How did you get to this point of writing this specific book? Because I see it as somewhat of a departure, or maybe a continuing turn of the ship, which is your life.
Well, you know, I think there's a lot of different ways we could talk about it. A friend of mine, he read it and he came over and he was like, "Whoa, this is a new Shauna Nyquist." And I think, you know, to a certain extent, that's true. This is an old Shauna Nyquist. This is the girl I was in college. This is the girl I was when I was 10. This is the one that I lost a little bit along the way when I was working really hard to prove how competent and capable I was. So this is, in many ways, a return to what I believe is my essential self that God made me to be. And it's also sort of it's very much a midlife book. I'm 40. I just turned 40 last week. And I think there's something about this midlife passage that says, I'm starting to understand who I am and who I'm not. And I'm starting to see the limitations of time. And I don't want to spend the next big chunk of my life playing someone else's part. And so I think certainly being competent and responsible and hardworking and kind of together, those are good things. But I think if I'm honest, my essential self, it's way more important to me to be soft and connected and warm and silly and spontaneous. Those words mean a lot more to me than competent, responsible, together, efficient. And so I'm clearing a way to go back to that girl and to reclaim her. I live in a world that values speed and efficiency, but in my heart of hearts, what I really value is hospitality and connection. Mm-hmm. And so I'm sort of staking out a new territory for me because I think it's the place I belong.
And I think also our Western culture lends itself to the kind of life that you just described prior, that speed and efficiency and some of the things that can get in the way of a more soulful way of life that we see in some other cultures that I think embrace this a little better. I think one of the questions I'm grappling with, and I don't know what your thoughts are on this, is it something that happens to everyone? Do we all lose our way and then I don't think we all refined our way, I will say that, but is it an essential part of the journey to sort of lose our way and hopefully then find it and recover it? Or do we not have to lose our way? I'm not sure. You know, that's been my own experience, and I don't like the term lose our way, just, but you know what I'm asking.
Well, you know, I would say a couple things about it. I think it is a lot of it depends on your personality. Mm-hmm. Like my husband, I tease him sometimes. Like he has never not been himself for one second on this planet.
I love it.
And it's such a gift. I love that about him. But like he doesn't get off track. Mm-hmm. You know, I would say he doesn't get off track based on the pressures or expectations of people outside of him. You know, he can make missteps based on what he wants or discerns in that moment, but he's not heavily affected by sort of the voice of the crowd. And I love that for him. And I learn a lot from him in that. But I would say I do get thrown off course. I will, in my less healthy moments, just be whatever someone tells me to be. And I'm learning how damaging that is. But I also would say we live in a culture that shouts, that doesn't whisper, that shouts. And there is if you're a woman with little kids in her 30s, I can just tell you exactly what that's supposed to look like. I can tell you what you're supposed to look like and what you're supposed to wear and what you're supposed to care about and what you're supposed to tag on Pinterest and the meals you're supposed to be making and the car you're supposed to be driving. The culture shouts so loudly at us. And so I think if you're a little bit more permeable, which I think maybe I am, a little more prone to taking on other people's expectations, you have to work really hard to lower the shouting and to stand in your own space. And that's been a huge challenge for me, but it's one that has changed everything.
Do you think that the church, the experience of, you know, growing up in our evangelical culture has exacerbated that?
I do think so. I think being a pastor's kid is sort of a recipe for it. I think being a woman makes it harder. And I think there is one thing I would say certainly is evangelicalism is such a broad tent at this point. Two people can use that word and have such entirely different understandings of it and experiences of it.
True.
So the way I grew up is really different than the way a lot of evangelicals grew up. But I will say the way I grew up, there is an expectation. There's a right way. There's a rightness within evangelicalism that goes far beyond theology. This is how we do everything, mm-hmm. you know? And I think I'm looking for a little space to say, I absolutely want us to share the most important core beliefs. But beyond that, I want there to be just 1 billion ways to do this well, you know?
That's a great way to put it. I love that. And I'm with you 1,000% there for sure. Here's a quote early on in the book. I loved this. You said, a wise friend told me that no one ever changes until the pain level gets high enough. I think there's huge truth there. And often that is what propels us to change or to leave someplace or to, you know, shift, make a move, whatever it is. I wish it didn't take that, but that's a piece of what happens, isn't it? In order to propel us forward in the journey.
You know, it has been for me. I most of the biggest changes I've made in my life have come because the previous way of living became unworkable. Mm. So I think if you can start looking at your pain, wherever you find it, in whatever area of life, as the catalyst you're going to need to move forward, I think that's a really helpful way to look at it. So the pain level got high enough and it propelled me into a new way of living that I'm really thankful for.
And I'm a fan of Richard Rohr. I loved his writings in Falling Upward, especially. And he says the skills that take you through the first half of your life are entirely unhelpful for the second half. And I think that's something that most of us have to grapple with at some level. And to me, I feel like this book, or at least as far as I've gotten in the book so far, is a piece of your grappling with that and trying to move into a different way of being. And I mean, I think a lot of people are going to deeply benefit from it. And I just want to say thanks for opening your life and putting that part of your journey on the page, because I mean, it is a vulnerable place. Is it scary for you, maybe even this book, to have written all of this and then release it? What is that feeling in your gut as you release a book like this?
Well, the great thing about it is, for better or for worse, I now have a lot of accountability to a present over perfect life. So essentially, what I said in the book is I'm done overvaluing frantic, and I'm choosing to believe that I am not what I do. I am not what I produce. I'm a daughter, not a factory worker, in a spiritual sense. I'm a, it's not about what I can produce or make. It's about living in deep connection mm-hmm. with the people that I love and with God and with the world that He created. Well, once you say all those things, there are a whole lot of people who are happy to remind you, and that's actually really, really great. You know, if I had written a book about like always working hard and never resting and never saying no, well, then my publishing team and the events I'm working on, and they'd be like, didn't you say you were going to never say no? Didn't you say you were going to show up to everything? Essentially, I did the opposite. And so now the teams I'm working with are just, they're so great. They're like, well, I know you really value your time with your family. I know you really value, and I'm like, thank you. Yes, I do. So I've got a whole lot of people right now who are willing to remind me that I'm choosing simpler and choosing slower. And that really helps me when I get off track.
I love it. Was there a specific turning point for you? A lot of times that's what it takes in someone's life, whether it was, your own realization or imposed from somewhere else. But did you have a spot where you were like, hands thrown in the air, cannot do this anymore?
Yeah, there were several moments, but one I remember so clearly is I was speaking at an event in Dallas, and I'd already been to Dallas 3 times that month, which Dallas is fine, but no one should go there 3 times a month, from Chicago.
Yeah.
And I was speaking at another event, and normally, if on the lunch break, I would just sit with whoever was there or whoever was at my table. But this time I went up to my hotel room and I laid on the bed, fully clothed, shoes on, staring at the ceiling. And I said, if anybody else wants to try to live this life I've created for myself, they are more than welcome to it, but I'm out. I can't, I don't have what it takes. I don't have the energy anymore. I don't have the drive anymore. I don't have the strength anymore to carry the weight of the schedule I've created for myself and the set of responsibilities I've created for myself. And so I went home and first conversations with my husband and then with my mentor and then with my dad and then with our small group. And I just kind of said, like, I think I've been trying to carry a life that I don't have the strength to carry anymore. And I don't totally know what it looks like from here, but I need to find a new way of living.
That's pretty big. That's a big spot to arrive at. And it also, the downside or the sticking point is it can't / doesn't change overnight when you get to that spot, because you still had engagements on the calendar. You're looking down the road a piece before you can really make significant or substantial change.
Oh, absolutely. And I had a conversation with someone yesterday and he said, so you got to that point and then you just sort of shut everything down.
Yeah, no.
That sounds nice.
Right on.
I did not, sir. I said, well, yeah, I mean, I was booked out for 18 months and I had publishing deadlines and I had a baby and I had a 5-year-old. And, this stuff wasn't going to change overnight. but that's how life is, right? Like you have these moments where you realize I need to make serious, significant changes. But that doesn't mean like I went and lived in a cottage on the lake for a year and a half. It meant I did the very slow, unglamorous work of a Christian counselor and seeing a spiritual director and learning how to say no and talking with my friends again and again and again and going to a doctor. And, you know, I mean, this was not an overnight change and it wasn't a simple change. It was a comprehensive, slow, one step forward, two steps back journey. And I'm still on it. I'm by no means nailing this, but I have fundamentally shifted a couple things in the foundation of my life and it has changed so much.
Well, and I think I'm deeply grateful that you mentioned the slowness of the change too, and also the reality that there are underlying things. I'm deeply grateful that you mentioned spiritual direction and going to a counselor, because if it were as easy as just, I'm not going to book myself silly with speaking engagements or, you know, writing books, if it were that simple and you just had to endure the next 18 months and then everything after that was fine, I mean, we'd all be doing it possibly. But, you know, it's not. There are underlying deals that we have to work on, work through. And I'm thinking of my own personal history. For me, I realized a whole lot of my image of God was wrapped up in the way I lived my life. Not even a conscious, I mean, it was not at all conscious, but there was that sense that I was like earning my place, or, you know, I was no better than the, you know, someone trying to earn their salvation, if you will. I did not look at it like that, but that was certainly a piece of it that I had to work through. Something in my view of God also propelled me down this path. Now, I don't know, is there any of that, or was there any of that with you?
Absolutely. You know, I think I went into this kind of hoping like this is about time management, right? Like everybody has an app on their phone that I just don't have yet. And once I have the app, things are going to be fine.
I love that.
And what I realized was this was absolutely about my understanding of God and of, for whatever reason, you know, I'm still trying to figure this out. I understood being a good soldier on his behalf. Mm. I did not totally understand what it meant to be loved unconditionally. And when that started to take root in my life, that's when everything started to change. But it was not overnight and it was not easy. And I think about it sort of like if you picture baking bread. I'm not a great baker, but I do know how to bake bread. So you can have like the flour and the water and the salt, and then separately the yeast. And they can sit right next to each other. But you're never going to bake bread unless that yeast has worked its way all the way through every part of that dough. The yeast is what transforms it from flour and water into bread. And I feel like I had my spiritual life and my whole life was the flour and the water. And then separately was the yeast. And the yeast was God's unconditional love. And I saw it over there. I understood it in my brain. But it had not worked its way through the actual kind of dough of my life in a transformational way. And so what a lot of this process was saying, just setting them side by side is not going to change anything. I actually have to physically, like hands dirty, work this yeast through the dough, and that's what's going to give it a chance to transform. Mm.
Yeah, which is not what most of us want. I mean, we do want the snap of the fingers, but it just, frankly, isn't what happens or how it happens. And I think nothing sticks if it's the snap of the fingers, too. And God knows that full well. But I love hearing that. I think our view of God is so wrapped up in so much of what we do and how we are in this world, that that's a piece. And it just takes some internal digging and working. And it's not always fun, but it's pretty important. I'm curious. I think it would be helpful for anyone that's listening to the podcast to know if there are any particular spiritual practices that have been especially meaningful for you. Not every spiritual practice connects with everybody, and you know what you might talk about may or may not be something for, you know, that would connect with someone listening. But I think it's always helpful to learn about those practices. So what's it been for you, or what maybe in the past, and what's working and helping you right now?
I think I sort of thought a lot of the contemplative practices were for like contemplative people, right? Like I'm an extrovert. I like to be busy. Like I think I sort of thought contemplative practices are, you know, are for introverts who like to be alone. My spiritual practices really are, you know, like hospitality and chatting, you know? And some of that's true. That is a gift and a passion area. But I think I'm coming to see the opposite in really clear ways, that the people who most benefit from contemplative practices are the ones who go at it kicking and screaming the most. You know, like my husband and my mom are contemplatives, mystics, thinkers, dreamers, very much introverts. Of course, contemplative practices work for them. I think what God uses to change both of their lives is action, right?
Yes.
Connection, movement. So for me, contemplative practices are a life changer because they go so deeply against the grain of how I live day to day. And so the couple, I would say the three that spring to mind are centering prayer, Sabbath, and like silence and solitude, because they're the most outside of the norm for how I would choose to live if left to my own devices. So I went on a silent retreat last fall, and I absolutely loved it. It filled up, it connected with me in such a deep way. It gave me such a deep sense of rest and peace. And I realized how often I've been filling the space with my own words and how much there is to be gained from the practice of silence.
Well, let me interject this question into the middle of that. For someone who's heard about solitude and silence and, you know, going on a retreat like you did, what did you have any fears going into it? Any, like, wondering, can I do this? Can I make this? What and how were those fears quelled, if you had some?
Well, and I would say I am so bad at this that I really did have to work up to it. Like, I didn't just, like, go from my life as it was then to a silent retreat. I think that would have sort of...
Sure, sure. And I was hoping you would say that. I mean, I think that's helpful and important to break out. I mean, you got that combination of introverts and extroverts listening, and I think it's helpful to hear the extroverted view of this. I think it's super important. I'm an introvert, and it's just, those things are a lot easier for me. But I think even the introvert still has some of those concerns, like, oh, really that long? What will it be like? Or, you know.
I would say when I first started practicing silence and solitude, and I see them, you know, very much kind of the same practice, I would feel anxious after minutes, not hours, minutes. And I really had to push myself. And I thought, what an interesting coincidence that I keep myself so busy all the time and I don't just happen to prefer silence. What I realized was I kept myself busy very much on purpose so that I never had to experience what I would find in the silence. So what I found in the silence was the most troubling part. I found sort of this deep lack of love for myself. I found this deep absence of connection with God's unconditional love for me. I found this, all of a sudden it became very clear to me, like, oh, it's no accident that you don't live with a meaningful practice of silence. Your entire life is set up to avoid what you find in this silent space. And so I had to keep returning to it, but it was very hard. It was very painful, but it was there that I kind of wrestled through to find a new way of connecting with God and understanding my own value, not for what I created, but because I have been created. But that was a difficult, I would say the practice of silence got way worse before it got better. Now, several years into that practice, I find it as a very healing, grounding space. It's where I figure out what I feel about things. It's where I allow God to remind me what he feels about me. But it did become more difficult and scary before it became better. So sort of a warning.
Well, which I think is helpful to hear. And maybe this is backtracking a little bit, but I think it'd be helpful for someone who's at that point where they're realizing, oh my goodness, I need to make a serious change, a real shift. And I'm a little nervous. Talk to that person that wants to move toward that simpler way of being, but I mean, you know, they don't have an idea even how to get from point A to point B, because I think that's where it starts probably.
You know, the two things that I would say, if you just want to begin on this journey, the two things that I think would be helpful for steps, number one, talk to the people closest to you about it. Start letting them know, hey, I feel an ache for a new way of living. I think it's more about simplicity. I don't want to be as busy as I've been. I don't want my default speed to be quite so fast. And I don't know how to do it, but I'm letting you know that this change is coming. And some of what that does is it's, you know, I would say the people closest to me have been like my training wheels mm-hmm. along this path. They have reminded me when I've forgotten. They've encouraged me when I've failed. They've held me accountable when I forget and sign up for 1 million things. And so that if you want to go on this journey alone, what might happen is people who have always experienced you one way all of a sudden are like, what's happening over there? You know? So I sort of got ahead of that and said, like, I'm going to let you know what's going to happen over here. And it's going to be different. I don't totally know how it's going to go. But I want to let you know, if it seems like I'm in sort of like a weird change space, I am. Mm-hmm. I totally am. I'm trying to figure out a new way of living. And if it feels sort of awkward and strange, like, I get it. It feels awkward and strange for me too. So number one, bring your closest circle of people in on the journey. And then number two, start practicing silence, even just 5 minutes a day.
Yes.
5 minutes. Set the timer on your phone and practice sitting in silence 5 minutes a day. And what you will find probably is that you hate it, and you realize you hate it because you need it. It's sort of like yoga. Like, the easy poses are never the ones that are going to change your body, right?
Yeah.
But the ones that are going to really transform your body are the ones that hurt a little bit. Mm-hmm. And so not bad hurt, but like good stretchy hurt. And so I think if it feels difficult, you're onto something.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. I think that's really helpful. Personally, I've benefited partly, and folks on the podcast have heard me talk about this. I married a guy who, he's a pastor, but he grew up Catholic, you know, all the way, grade school, high school, university, and graduate school. So I personally have really benefited from some of the things that I've learned from him, the Catholic faith tradition. I'm wondering if there have been other faith traditions that have helped you along the way as well.
Well, you know, growing up in Chicago, all my friends are Catholic. all my best friends from growing up are Catholic. So I've spent a lot of time learning from them. And so I've certainly learned so much from the Catholic tradition, but also so much from the Jewish tradition, particularly the practice of Sabbath. Mm-hmm. It was interesting. It's a long story, but I ended up at a Shabbat service, and it, you know, it's mostly in Hebrew, so I don't understand. And because we wanted to connect with some of the families there, we brought our kids. Well, I mean, I think Mac was three. So we realized like 2 minutes in, this is not going to happen. So my husband and Henry experienced the whole service. What I experienced was all the other parents whose kids couldn't sit still running around the lobby, which was actually so fascinating because we were all just sitting there and our kids were playing together. And so we had a conversation together. And I remember one of the women saying, I'm not really a practicing Jew. Like, I grew up this way, but I'm just here for someone's bat mitzvah. But I was just asking her about her experience. And even as a non-practicing Jewish person, she said something. I said, you know, part of why I'm here is because I want to learn about Sabbath. And she said, Sabbath is the greatest connective tissue for Jewish people. This is the center of our faith experience. The thing that sets us apart in the world, that makes Judaism different from anything else, is the practice of the Sabbath. I thought that's fascinating because, you know, a lot of evangelicals would say what's different about us is our beliefs, the things we think in our mind.
Yeah.
That's what defines us. And so she was saying, I don't believe a lot of these things, but this practice of Sabbath is what connects us and what keeps us connected to our faith and to one another. Mm-hmm. That's really a fascinating way to look at it. And, you know, we joke about it sometimes. Like, it's interesting that Christians would have 10 commandments and 9 that we take very seriously and 1 that we just completely disregard.
That's great. That's true. So true.
It's true. Like, yeah. I grew up in and still am a part of an environment that just has really nothing to say about the actual practice of Sabbath. And I want to grow in that way. And I want to introduce my kids to a practice of Sabbath in a way that I still am just tiptoeing into.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I learn a lot. Aaron and I have some friends who are rabbis, a married couple who are rabbis. And the way that they talk about Sabbath is really beautiful to me and really inspiring. And so I think whenever you trust your own tradition enough to learn from other traditions, mm-hmm. There's nothing scary about learning from other traditions if you are deeply connected and rooted in your own. You know, I'll be Dutch and Irish till the day I die, but it doesn't mean I don't love Italian food. It doesn't make me Italian as much as I wish it did.
Yeah, I love it. I appreciate that deeply. And I think the learning from other traditions is I think people, we underestimate that. And I think sometimes there's fear there. So I appreciate your words about that. When you're grounded in your own, you can learn from others. And I was just thinking about the whole Sabbath thing too. When I left my work at Moody, I didn't realize how, not just emotionally and spiritually, but physically tired I was, and how I had ignored the Sabbath for so long that I needed weeks and months of actual deep rest for all parts of my being. And I think had I not been, you know, let go and kind of forced into that, I wouldn't be there still. So sometimes it is that forcing. Sometimes it's health that pushes someone to that point, or, you know, fill in the blank, whatever it is. And it just happened to be, for me, job related, but and I think I'm still kind of in recovery physically from that. And I wonder, had all those years, had I practiced Sabbath, would I be feeling the same or have had such a deep need? Don't you wonder that?
Well, and I think that's something where our faith culture and the wider culture, I think we're all asking those same questions. You know, Arianna Huffington is writing she released a book about sleep.
Yep.
And you go, like, that doesn't seem right for this incredibly kind of powerful voice who has this huge job, but, you know, she's talking about like an epidemic in our culture of people who are not rested and therefore are not able to live whole, healthy, connected lives and not able to make good business decisions. So I think this is wider than just something we experience in our faith culture. I think we live in a world that has not learned how to rest our bodies, let alone rest and nourish our souls. So I think it's a really important thing for all of us.
And I think what I see too is often we write out of our own, I mean, this is, I guess, a no-brainer, but we write out of our own area of wounding or our own area of need, or, I mean, that's part of it too. So I think it's interesting that she's writing about that fast paced that she lives in. It's, I mean, ever present. And so I love that. I appreciate that. And I mean, the same thing's true for you. I love this, leaving behind frantic for a simpler, more soulful way of living. It's like, God, help us to do that. Help us. What's a final word? What do you want to say to folks in parting that's not been said here today as we've conversed? You know, I mean, there's so much more in the book, but what's a parting word that you really want to get in there?
I would say if anything about this connects with your life, if you feel exhausted, if you feel disconnected from your most, you know, the most key relationships in your life, if you feel like you've lost some of that essential self, if I can make this change, anybody can make this change. And it won't be fast and it won't be super direct, but this is a journey. It's a difficult journey, but it's one that's 1,000% worth taking. Mm-hmm. I am more thankful for this journey than any other journey in my life except the journey toward faith. Mm-hmm. This is the number two most significant life change in my life.
Pretty powerful words. How can people connect with you? I'll link to your website from my homepage at anitalustria.com, but give out that website or whatever else you want to give out right now.
Yeah, you can go to shaunaniquist.com or presentoverperfect.com.
Okay.
Good. Or on Instagram, I'm S. Niequist, and that's my favorite.
Okay. Got to make sure I'm following there. I think I am. That's great. I'll post all that and make sure people can connect if they forget those websites. Shauna, thank you. Thanks not just for writing about it, but being available to talk about it as well. I think you give us a lot of hope, and praying people kind of take you up on moving this direction and walking this kind of journey. So thanks for being with us.
Thank you. It's been great to talk with you. It's been my pleasure.
Thank you. I'm Anita Lustria, and this is Faith Conversations.